Time now for hour number two of this week's two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, of course, the star of the show, Carol Marx, front and center now, interviewing William Bushong. He's a White House historian and contributor on the book titled Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents, published by National Geographic.
In the book, you answer a lot of common questions that people have about the White House. Why is it white? I was kind of shocked. And why is the Oval Office oval-shaped? And I was so interested at these answers.
Yeah, it's that's an old question, I think, that goes back to everyone's when in the old days when they took civics or history in high school or even middle school, that question came up, and usually the answer was given that, oh, that's because the British burned the house during the War of 1812, and there were scorch marks left that had to be covered by white paint. But that's not the true story, as you probably know from reading the book, that it was the Scottish stonemasons who were the first to paint the house white. And they did it for a very practical purpose. After they completed the walls of the White House in 1798, they basically used the paint as a kind of a sealant to keep moisture out of the stone. Now, the stone that was used was a quiet stone from northern Virginia. And it's a sandstone that's a bit porous, so as a consequence, water will, you know, seep into the stone, and then during the winter it will freeze and cause it to crack and spall. So that's what they were trying to avoid. And so presidents, as they came into office, or came into reside at the White House, John Adams being the first resident onward, just continued to paint the house to give it a fresh and clean look every year. And then by the time we got to the administration of Jimmy Carter, there were 42 layers of paint on the house that had to be cleaned off.
And what about the Oval Office? How did that come about?
The Oval Office is an interesting story too, and it has a background in history and tradition, as you might imagine. The history basically goes back to the day when George Washington used to hold what were called levees, which were these formal gatherings where he would greet people at the White House. And in Philadelphia, he had a bow actually formed in one of the rooms so that you could create this circle in the room, and then you would go around, bow to the president. You didn't shake hands in that period, and then move around, and he would greet each person as they'd go through. That was a tradition that was ended by Thomas Jefferson, who began to just shake hands. You know, it was far more Republican than Democratic and straightforward. But in the original design of the house, James Hoban, who designed the White House since 1792, created three major oval rooms in the structure that go on the first, second, and third levels. And on that second level, in the main state floor, is the Blue Room. And that's where the president officially would greet diplomats, as well as continue these receptions and greet people as they'd come into the White House. So when President Taft had the what had been a small office annex built by TR in 1902, expanded out in 1909, they had a Oval Office built, and the idea was to continue that ceremony into this office structure, because before that, the presidents worked on the second floor of the White House in the east side of the building, so there wasn't a separate office. Literally, the president worked above the store, so the idea was to create a formal ceremonial space within the office complex that would be a place where the president worked, as well as continue to greet members of Congress, dignitaries, and others. And as you know today, that famous photo op is always held in the Oval Office of today, where you see the leaders of nations from around the world who usually they'll sit in the chairs in front of the fireplace and have their photograph taken as the first part of an official visit.
Now, talking about presidents' offices, way back when, I didn't realize that what we now call Lincoln's bedroom was really his office.
Well, it wasn't his bedroom. He used that room as an office, and it later became
the Lincoln
bedroom.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, sure. And that's true. And that was officially given that name by Harry Truman after his restoration of the renovation of the White House between 1949 and 1952. But the by the time of after once TR had converted the office space out into the west side of the house, which eventually became the west wing, that east wing became open, and just as you were saying, you know, Lincoln had his office in there, just as all the presidents did before 1902, And so as a consequence, that space was freed up, and then it was converted into guest bedroom spaces. And that's so it was it became known as the Lincoln bedroom, and they, because they would put the Lincoln bed that Mrs. Lincoln had bought in that room, and along with the furnishings that she had bought, and it became sort of the best guest room, so to speak.
I think that the balcony and the that President Truman put on is the second floor balcony is just so beautiful, and he really renovated the exterior of the White House. He did it very well. So why was that second floor balcony controversial? I think it's great.
Well, the architects at the time were the most vocal in their opposition to it, and their thought was is that two things. One, there had not been any real alterations on the exterior facade of the White House since the 1830s, and felt like, you know, that really was not appropriate. But the second thing they cited was they felt like it sort of created a cut through the south portico, you know, in terms of a visual cue there, that it cut the what had been a tall you know space that you would enjoy out on the veranda there, and created this you know sort of division that sort of was in their minds awkward. But as we know now, all the presidents and first families that have lived in the White House since Truman love that balcony because it gives them that privacy and a sense of space that they can actually sit out and enjoy in the evenings without having, everyone in their around them sort of, you know, looking at them and seeing that they're out on the porch, and they can have and use it like we would, you know, like anyone would use a porch on their own house.
Absolutely. Now, I love reading about some of the more unconventional events that took place at the White House that are inside the White House, and one certainly was, wow, the wild inaugural reception of President Jackson. So what happened? I never heard about it.
Well, Andrew Jackson, as you know, was the man of the people, as he was called in his time, and he was a very popular elected president, and he brought with him a lot of supporters from the West, Western states, who just had a different way of doing things. They loved to party and have a good time, and they weren't so hung up on sort of the etiquette and traditions. And so they all descended on the White House and in mass, and to see, you know, and it just became a crazy scene because so many people were there. I mean, the old establishment were used to these sort of quiet decorum of, you know, people coming in and greeting the president, shaking his hand very quietly, and just sort of like, you know, a nice sort of parlor atmosphere. Well, these folks had coming in, they were standing on the furniture in muddy boots and drinking rum punches and getting a little rowdy and, you know, having a good time, basically. And so it got pictured, I think, as just a rabble who had come upon the White House because, as you can see, there's a political backdrop there in terms of, like, Jackson coming in and representing, a populist movement, in essence, and some of the old establishment didn't appreciate that, and as a consequence, criticized his followers pretty handily because of that. And so I think that has grown now to, a mythological proportion of this crazy, wild rabble that came down on the White House during the inauguration of Andrew Jackson.
So I'm glad to hear more of a true story there. And I also enjoy reading about the first inauguration held in Washington in 1801, when President-elect Jefferson, after walking to the Capitol for his swearing-in, returned to his boarding house. And boy, what a contrast to what goes on today. Unbelievable.
Yes, it is. I mean, that's another tradition that has just grown by leaps and bounds over the years. And Jefferson started out very modestly, but eventually honor guards began to join the president and escort him down the avenue. And now we've gotten into full-blown parades and military formations and bands and you name it, coming down the avenue for hours on end with the president overlooking this celebration.
Now, inside the White House also has some delightful pictures in it of our president's wives, and I so enjoyed the picture that showed Betty Ford dancing on the cabinet room table in 1977. So what caused her to do that? And didn't she have a lot of moxie and courage to do it?
Oh, certainly. Mrs. Ford was just a true gem, a wonderful lady, and I had the privilege of knowing working for many years here at the association with her social secretary, Maria Downs, and I've heard a number of stories about Mrs. Ford that just sort of bring her to life as a person. I just real warm-hearted, wonderful lady from what I gathered from people who knew her. But what happened was is at the end of the Ford administration, just as, you know, of course they'd lost the election, so you can imagine what a White House is like when you've lost an election and everybody's down and, you know, long faces are everywhere. And, well, anyway, Mrs. Ford thought, well, you know what, I'm going to do something crazy and I'm going to, you know, lighten the mood here at the White House. So that's why she did what she did. She got on the cabinet table and did a little dance, and the staff photographer David Kennerly was there, and he shot that famous image, and it's I think it just sort of captures a delightful moment in and something of Mrs. Ford's personality, but also it sort of reminds us that, you know, she was a dancer and a very, you know, sprightly figure in her own right. So it's just a warm and wonderful kind of image that captures a moment in time.
It sure is. Now, the chapters inside the White House all have themes, including the building and the grounds, the working White House, diplomacy and ceremony. Do you have a favorite that we haven't had time to mention? Because there's so much in your book.
Oh yeah, there is, and it's since it's the holiday season, the story I really enjoy is the one of Horace Vose, who was the Rhode Island poultry dealer who basically built up his business through sending prized turkeys to the presidents for many, many years. He started with U.S. Grant and went all the way up through Taft, sending them his best turkey. These birds were not pardoned. They were slaughtered and dressed and then shipped to the president. And they always weighed at least 35 and sometimes as high as 50 pounds. So just monster birds and just that he would send. And they were apparently the cat's meow as far as the best birds of the flock. He would go through Rhode Island and Connecticut and pick out the best birds for the market in New York anyway. That was his business. But then he would send what he considered his prize bird down south to the president every year, and it was always a big event. The newspapers covered it, you know, the arrival of the bird from Horace Vose. So it's really kind of an interesting and fun story that relates to Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays at the White House.
That's William Bashong in conversation with Carol Marks. He's a White House historian, and he's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents, published by National Geographic. For more information, go to the website whitehousehistory.org. A Touch of Gray continues in a moment.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health, you look healthy, and you feel fine? But that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Doesn't always cause symptoms, but it can be prevented. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
I'm dreaming tonight of a place.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Mairead Nesbitt. She's the fiddle player for Celtic Woman, and she's going to talk about the new special deluxe edition Home for Christmas CD on Manhattan Records, bundled with the brand new Home for Christmas Live from Dublin DVD.
What's the difference between a violinist and a fiddle player, or is that just semantics?
Well, first of all, lovely to be back. Thank you so much for having me. And that's a really good question. It really is. It's actually the same instrument. And really, it's down to style, I think. You know, I think some classical musicians would call their instrument a violin, and some folk and jazz and traditional musicians would call it a fiddle. But either or, you can have it vice versa as well. You can have some classical players that call it a fiddle and some, you know, traditional players that call it a violin, but it's actually the same instrument.
So you'd call Itzhak Perlman a violinist?
Yeah, you would, yeah. Yes, you would.
And I understand he was one of your early influences, no?
Absolutely. I just think he's such an amazing player. I mean, what a person as well, you know. And, you know, just to I don't know, to have the go in him to be, to propel himself to be really one of the absolute best violinists in the world, up in the top five for sure, you know, and he's incredible, absolutely incredible.
Well, we're going to go see him in February. He's doing a tour of the country, so we're looking forward to that. But you've also played with Van Morrison, and I'm thinking, boy, there's a wide range of music that you play and that you like. Do you have a preference in terms of pop music, Celtic music, or classical music that you enjoy particularly?
Well, I actually have lots of different, you know, lots of different favorites, I think. Basically, I like, you know, just taking elements of different styles, and I just love music from different genres. I love anything that's good and different. I love to listen to, especially music that's different, because I think you can always, you're always learning. You never stop learning, and I think it's very important as a musician to stay fresh and to just try different things. And you know, I think it's important also that musicians have their own style. And I think, you know, if you look away from the television or if you hear something, you know, playing in a shop or on the radio or something like that, if you know who it is, then that musician is doing, you know, a good thing, obviously, you know, and they've stamped their own style on something. So I think it's always very important to listen to everything.
Now, Mairead, you started playing the violin probably around age 6, but when did you start playing the violin and dancing at the same time?
I think I was always doing that. I think, you know, really the music is the most important thing. And, you know, I think I always say that to children. You know, they would say, oh, how do you do that? You know, how do you move and play at the same time? But I always say to them, the music is the most important thing. The movement is just a bonus thing. It's not even something I ever think about, you know. And it's not something really one should think about. It's the music that's the most important thing.
So do you choreograph the dancing at all, or is that pretty spontaneous in terms of what you do?
It's spontaneous, yeah, it is. I mean, we have a fantastic choreographer for Celtic Woman called Darren Crosby, and he does all the choreography for Celtic Woman, and he is amazing, and he just tells me, just, you know, come in that entrance and go out that exit. Just do whatever you want. You know, so as long as it makes sense to the music, and he has given me that freedom, you know, I think it's you know, if it doesn't make sense to the music, then I don't do it.
The music that you get given to you, is that it, or do you have some input in terms of what songs you would like to do? For example, if you discover a new song that you hear on the radio that you'd like to bring to the table, can you do that, or is it pretty much all set way in advance?
Well, we have a fantastic musical director called David Danz, and he is really in charge of the music. And we're basically, you know, the four girls on stage we have a lot of work to do. We've actually enough work to do, and it's great to have somebody of David's caliber to take control over that. And, you know, just to, you know, to suggest different types of music. And also, I suggest music as well, that maybe the violin might want to do. But, you know, it's really David's decision, and we're actually very good with that because we have so much to do ourselves. You know, that we're delighted that David has all that responsibility.
Mairead, does the music change as the tour goes on, or is it pretty much a set show from top to bottom?
Well, we change the set list before every tour. And, you know, but once the tour starts, because it's such a big, big production, we have, you know, obviously all the sound, all the lighting especially, as well, like, it all makes sense with what you're going to do next. So, I mean, unless there's something that we really, really want to do, we like to keep, you know, a tour an actual entity, you know, and just get into it and get into the groove of that tour. Then when we finish that tour, we change it up again then for the next tour.
Now, you do a lot of Christmas shows, obviously, and we're in that festive time of the year. What is different about this year's Christmas show versus some of the previous ones?
Well, yes, we were actually in the middle of our wonderful symphony tour called Home for Christmas, and it's really, really wonderful because we get to play with symphony orchestras every, you know, for the whole tour, but there's a different symphony orchestra in every city, and we literally have just pulled in this morning into another city again, and so we're, you know, basically we're on a rock and roll schedule, but with the pure voices and playing, you know, so it's it is a strenuous you know, routine, but really it's all worth it when we get to come in and play with such wonderful symphony orchestras. And you know, the one this year, actually we have a new member, Mairead Carlin, and so she has joined us for her first Christmas tour with us, and she's absolutely wonderful. So that's a change. And we've done, of course, we have just released our new DVD, Home for Christmas, which has lots of new music on it, and we have put that new music into this new tour for this year. So lots of lovely Christmas music, new Christmas music for people to enjoy on this tour as well.
Now, you were married a couple of years ago after touring a long time as a single lady. How has that changed your touring schedule, and do you start to think, well, maybe I want to have a family someday, or is Celtic Woman your primary commitment right now?
Well, actually, that's a good question. I'm very lucky in that my husband at the moment travels. I mean, we met on tour, and he's actually the lighting director for Celtic Woman. And so we tour together. So we're very, very lucky to have that. And even though he's on a different schedule to me, you know, we're still very, very lucky to have that. Sorry, Richard, I'm just in the middle of, we're actually on the bus at the moment, and that's the joys of touring. so the thing is, I think, you know, because it's Celtic Woman, of course, has had different lineups a little bit, over the last few years. And, I think that, you know, being women, we, you know, want to, you know, settle down and start a family and that kind of thing. And that's been, you know, or add to our families as well, you know. So, and that's been the beauty of Celtic Woman over the years. So I'm sure that time will come at some stage.
That's Mairead Nesbitt in conversation with Richard Neer. She is the fiddle player for Celtic Woman, and you can go to CelticWoman.com for more information. Richard Neer returns when A Touch of Grey continues.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can count on.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're going to be joined for the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now will be speaking with Rick Goldschmidt, the biographer and official historian for Rankin Bass Productions, the folks behind all those Christmas classics. He's going to discuss how the shows were created and the famous actors who lent their voices to the shows, including Burl Ives, Jimmy Durante, and Mickey Rooney. Richard, that's cool stuff. Mickey Rooney. We had him on A Touch of Gray once. It was so cool.
Yeah. I have often wanted to do that. It seems like so much fun to be able to voice an animated feature, you know, to play a character, and you know, your face isn't shown, but you can be anything. You can be an old man, you could be a child, you know, depending on how versatile your vocal cords are.
Can you do a Jimmy Durante imitation?
Good night, Mrs. Calabash, whatever you are.
I can't handle it. It's under the big W. I kicked a bucket. It's under the big W.
There's a lot of folks who probably have no idea who Jimmy Durante
Nobody
is.
Nobody listening to this show, they all know who Jimmy Durante is.
Well, you know, it's funny. I wonder about Jimmy Durante, Red Skelton, people like that. If they came out today, would they be as big as they were then? I mean, Red Skelton, my family used to watch him every week religiously. They love Hunkadiddle Hopper and his character.
They were for the times. They were of the times. You have to understand the times to be able to understand how a person becomes a star or a musical performer or a comedian. Red Skelton was gigantic in the golden age of television, as was Uncle Milty and Lucy and people like that.
Burl Ives was an interesting character, in as much as, you know, I think the most played Christmas song at Christmas on radio is Burl Ives doing "Have a Holly Jolly,
Jolly Christmas." Yeah.
But the first time I ever saw Burl Ives, I was a little kid who went to the movies and saw a movie that was for adults. Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
He was Big Daddy.
He was Big Daddy, and he scared the... I didn't know what that movie was about. I sat there watching that whole movie. I had no idea. Elizabeth Taylor, Paul Newman, and Burl Ives. And Burl Ives' Big Daddy scared the hell out of me. And I could never imagine that that Big Daddy was the same guy that sang, "Have a holly jolly..." It just didn't... It didn't connect. And I've always looked at Burl Ives as just being his own iconic individualistic self in the pantheon of stars. But he, too, is fading over the horizon of time. And these people were iconic. When you and I were children growing up, they were gigantic pillars of the pop culture. And now, you know... they're fading over the horizon. Look, we're going to take a break. We're going to hear you talking about this. And then I want to discuss with you on the other side of your conversation. I want to talk a little bit about the changes in culture in terms of ethics, in terms of honesty, in terms of corruption. And I'd like to get your take on it. Richard Neer's with us. I'm Michael Harrison. At Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, "You're the picture of health"? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison, the anchor seat, and as promised, here's Richard Neer in conversation with Rick Goldschmidt, the biographer and official historian for Rankin Bass. Rankin Bass Productions are the people behind all those Christmas classics. He's going to discuss with Richard how the shows were created and the famous actors who lent their voices to the shows, including Burl Ives, Jimmy Durante, and Mickey Rooney.
Rick, I know that those of us in the business know Rankin Bass, but I think people, lay people who are just viewers, may not understand what Rankin Bass is all about. They may think it's something to do with fishing. They may think it has to do with Kenny Rankin. They may think it has to do with infomercials. Tell us about Rankin Bass and what they are.
Well, Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass started the company in the late 50s. And they basically had a lot of television background by that time. Arthur Rankin was an art director for ABC Television, and Jules Bass was a jingle writer and a person that worked for the ad agencies in New York. So they put their talents together and decided to do animated programs, both in stop-motion animation, which they called Animagic, and in cell animation, and they did two series to start their career, The Tales of the Wizard of Oz in cell animation and The New Adventures of Pinocchio, which was in Animagic animation. And then in 1964, they did Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer for NBC and General Electric, and that just opened up a whole big can of worms for them, and they were able to branch out into feature films and animated Saturday morning series and live action shows for ABC, and it really became a whole empire of entertainment programming for many, many years.
And they're very famously known for their holiday specials. You mentioned Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. There was Frosty the Snowman, Frosty's Winter Wonderland, Rudolph's Shiny New Year. There were a whole bunch of holiday specials, no?
Yeah, they really cornered the market on the holiday specials. They did Here Comes Peter Cottontail for Easter. They did Santa Claus is Coming to Town and The Little Drummer Boy. They actually had specials on all three networks running simultaneously at times. So it was Rankin Bass were known after Rudolph for being able to put together some meaningful Christmas specials and holiday specials. And the networks just went to them, and they went to the networks and said, hey, we got this idea, we want to do this. And they would say, okay, do it. Now, today, it's much harder and much more complicated to try to get anything done. You know, an idea goes through a million hands today. Back then, it was just the networks giving the green light and Rankin Bass doing it. So it was quite an interesting assortment of things that they did, mostly through the mid-60s into the early 80s.
Now, they also were able to enlist a lot of very famous actors,
yes,
to do the voices for these characters, people like Andy Griffith and Burl Ives, and in radio, Casey Kasem, Danny Kaye, Boris Karloff, Jimmy Durante. I mean, the list goes on and on of the great famous people who did this. And I'm just wondering, I would think it would be very hard to enlist stars of that caliber today to do this kind of thing. How were they so successful in convincing all these people to participate?
Well, Arthur Rankin's father was an actor that appeared in many, many things. His grandfather's a famous actor, Harry Davenport. All of his family worked in vaudeville. He knew some of these people, you know, over the years just from his family relations. But he also knew that these actors had special talents. And people like Fred Astaire and Boris Karloff and all the people that he used, James Cagney, he knew that they had a certain persona and a certain quality to their voice that would be perfect for animation, whereas today they'll throw a lot of people in a movie, you know, just because they're famous. Whether or not they have any talent at all doesn't make any difference. They just want the name on the marquee. Whereas Rankin Bass used people that actually had a talent for bringing a character to life. And I think that's the big difference between what Rankin Bass did and what people are doing today.
Now Harryhausen, who recently passed, was one of the most famous stop-action people. He did Clash of the Titans and a lot of films like that. Did he ever work with Rankin Bass, and how was their technique similar to what he did or different than what he did?
No, he never worked with Rankin Bass, and I think his technique was similar in that he used a lot of intricate puppets that had various fabrics to them. Rankin Bass isn't a claymation type thing where it's Gumby and Pokey. It's more of a doll jointed figure that they change out the eyes and the mouths and give them certain kinds of movements on the screen that you don't get with claymation. It's more of an intricate puppet type thing that Tim Burton also used in Nightmare Before Christmas and Corpse Bride, although there was computer assistance with those shows. And Rankin Bass, they really just went frame by frame. All of the animation was done in Japan with Rankin Bass, so it differs from Ray Harryhausen in that it was all Japanese animators, and they have a certain technique and style that carried over into the Rankin Bass specials.
Well, I was going to bring that computer issue up because now, not that it's easy to do, but certainly the computer does a lot of the legwork. And back then, as you say, it's frame by frame. You had to move these things little tiny bits, 24 frames a second, just to make them look real. And it must have been a lengthy, painstaking process to actually produce one of these shorter films.
Yeah, it was a very tedious process. But, you know, when I look at them today, I see a warmth that comes through in the animation process that I don't see in CGI at all. The only good CGI that I've seen is the earlier Pixar stuff. I don't like any of the other studios' CGI animation. To me, it looks cheap and cold, which, you know, the Rankin Bass specials had a real warmth to them, and the style of animation is so charming. It's just totally missing from today's animation, in my opinion.
And, of course, there was music, and, you know, the stories were the thing, too. And these things continually run today, and I imagine they're available on DVD as well?
Oh, yeah, they're available on DVD and Blu-ray. And you mentioned the music. The music really had a lot to do with Maury Laws. He had, like, a bouncy holiday feel to all of his orchestrations. And then Jules Bass wrote the lyrics. And Romeo Muller wrote all of these stories. And he did it in such a way that it really was for the whole family. And it gave it such heart and warmth by reforming the villains like the Bumble and the Burgermeister and Winter Warlock, and just gave it such a nice feeling that people want to experience it over and over and over again. And that's where the Blu-rays and DVDs come in, and even they're still showing on the networks too. So They're going to last forever.
That's Rick Goldschmidt in conversation with Richard Neer. And if you want more information, go to miserbrothers.com. It's miserbros.com, miserbrothers.com. Okay, Richard Neer returns for some final words as we come to the concluding segment of our big two-hour get-together on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, in just a moment.
He's Mr. White Christmas, he's Mr. Snow. He's Mr. Icicle, he's Mr. Candelo.
Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch. He's too much.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and Richard Neer, our senior correspondent, is with us. And well, we talked earlier about corruption. I don't know. I get the feeling, Richard, and especially seems true during this, the season of goodwill and happiness and ethics and love and peace and all those lofty concepts. Do you get the feeling that scams and fraud and the spirit of deceit seem to be on the rise in terms of our culture? Or is it just that I'm getting smarter and older?
Both, but I agree that it is getting worse. And I think a lot of it has to do with the economy. When people need money, want money, or get greedy because they feel, well, this guy's got it and I don't, they come up with dishonest ways to get that money. And I'm not just talking about individuals. I'm talking about businesses who advertise falsely, who will... I just had a very negative experience with a car dealer who we agreed upon a price, and all of a sudden he tacks on all these extras as I'm about to to go a great distance to get this car. So things like that happen all the time now where honesty, you know, it used to be a man's as good as his word and a company, we stand behind our products. And there are still some companies that do, but there are a lot of them who are just trying to lure you in with whatever shady practice they can. And you're, you know, if you're a sucker or you're a nice guy and you don't want to cause friction, you'll go along with it.
Yeah, you don't want to argue. You don't want to haggle. You don't want to say, but you said that this was the price. Why? Where did this extra $500 come from, or this extra $200? What's this? You know, you don't want to seem like you're a schnook. But
yeah.
The fact is, they're the schnooks. I find that a lot of the advertising, and I got to be real careful because we're in a medium here that is based on advertising.
Yes.
But a lot of the sponsors today, a lot of the big companies, they advertise deceptively, like where they'll say for the price of one, you can get two or three items free. But if you look at it carefully, the price of the one is really the price of three. You're paying for them.
How many times do you see 70% off this week only, and then you look at the price last week, and it's pretty similar, and you say, well, 70 off, and then what they've done is they've raised the retail suggested price 70% and then dropped it to make it look...
Yeah, off what? I got to tell you, I am left with a bad taste in my mouth from this whole Black Friday thing that this year it just seemed to be, you know... I know I've never liked it as a good idea because I'm not that kind of person. And I understand some people like to shop as a sport, and that's fine. Some people like to save some money on something. If you can get a big, you know, item that's $2,000, you can get it for $500. You sit out all night to save $1,500. But it seems that Black Friday this past year was just, I don't know, fraudulent. It became Black Week, Black Month.
Especially when they open stores on Thanksgiving Day. And you know, I think the numbers showed that they didn't really gain any business by doing that. They just, people came out at night Thanksgiving instead of during the morning of the next
day. Right. And I don't know. I mean, you go to restaurants, you go to places, things are busy. You see people spending a fortune to eat dinners, and then you hear it's a recession. And it's just so hard to get a handle on it. But I get the feeling that the average American is struggling. The average working person's worried. If they haven't lost their job, they're afraid of losing it. They've suffered a pay cutback. And I just think that times are really hard right now. And yet the culture is aimed at affluence.
Consumerism. Spend more.
Yeah.
If you don't have this, you're not part of the hip people. You're not the cool if you don't have this product.
And get deeper and deeper in debt.
You don't have the lightest iPhone.
And I hate to say, I think one of the biggest perpetrators of this unsavory way of doing business are the banks. I think that, you know, the bank used to be your friend. The bank was a place of respect. Now you go into a bank and you feel like they're going to grab you for whatever they can on any front and give you the worst customer service. But let's end on a positive note. Richard, it is a pleasure working with you. Beverly Santanello, thank you for the fine job you do on the front line as our producer. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you, Kevin Casey, the entire team. And thank you, of course, Carol Marks, the founder and host of the program. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you back next year, next week, for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.